welcome to a brand new edition of Problematic Women. I'm Brittany Allen.
And I'm Kristen Eichhammer.
And joining us for the first time in studio is Nicole Robinson. She is a senior research associate in Heritage's Allison Center for National Security. Nicole, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
We're really excited to have you.
Finally getting you on. Yeah.
I know.
Well, for those of you who maybe weren't paying attention, women's basketball has been major point of discussion, especially following the March Madness. That was complete madness. I feel like my bracket blew up. I don't know if you guys made brackets, but mine did.
Did not.
Oh. Missed the deadline.
I wish that I had like auto-filled one, though, because sometimes you luck out and we have competition at work, as you all know, where you can win airline tickets. I'm like, maybe next year.
Yeah, there were some good prizes.
There were some really, really good prizes. Yeah, it was
And I picked Purdue, who, like, for the men's team, men's basketball, and they did very, very well. But we are talking about women's basketball, which is much more important.
Sorry, I did you.
No, you're good. And actually, on Monday, many watched the WNBA draft to see what the next era of female basketball might look like. And to no surprise, Iowa's Caitlin Clark was the number one draft pick of the night. She went to a Midwest team, Indiana Fever, and she, I mean, was kind of not surprising that she was the first pick. She's had the best college career. I think she's shattered both men and women basketball records. And also, she was in one of the final games that had the highest rating of viewers in the last 5 years. So that's pretty insane. Like, since pre-pandemic times, it was the most watched female basketball game, I think, ever. And then the most watched in the last 5 years. And I don't know. A lot of people are kind of like, why is this? Why does everyone obsess with Caitlin Clark? And I, you know, was pondering. And I don't know if you guys remember last year, Caitlin did very, very well, played against LSU. And I just think she's a class athlete. Like, have you been paying attention? You're a fellow Midwest girly.
Yeah. I've been looking at, I saw videos on Twitter of her dad. I don't know if there was one instance where she was getting very frustrated by a call or something and camera flashed to him and he was saying, like, calm down. Yeah. So I think it's a testament of her and, you know, what she's been doing. So.
For sure.
Well, Kristen, you sat in my office yesterday and just, like, went off on women's basketball and I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah. No, I mean,
I shamefully don't follow. I probably should, but in fairness, I don't follow any basketball. Not men's, not women's. And just, like,
That's what's cool is, like, I didn't either. I played soccer. I didn't really care. I watch football when it's on sometimes. This year, not really. But for Caitlin specifically, I just remember it's been over a year now. LSU's player, Angel Reese, was a total jerk after winning. And for those of you who maybe didn't see it, it was all over social media. Angel basically pointed at her finger. Iowa and LSU played in the championship last year. And she pointed to her finger and was like, I got the ring, you didn't, haha. And there's like seconds left in the game and Caitlin's just like not having it.
Such
and I just remember that moment. Right. I think a lot of people saw that and were like, oh my gosh, who is this girl? She's really good at basketball. Also, she didn't respond at all to this like trash talking. And there's been a lot of comments back and forth and people are like, well, everyone talks trash. Caitlin talks trash. But if you look at her, yeah, kind of maybe a little bit. She's competitive, but she's patriotic, stands for her flag. She respects everyone. And I mean, SNL, maybe not so much, but it's SNL. And she made it all about basketball. And I think we're starting to see more and more people appreciate it. We saw it with Barbie. We saw it with other movies that could have been politicized. Like, she just, it's about basketball for her.
Yep.
It's about hard work. She, like, a viral video of her training with her dad. Like, I think people want to return to that. And it's really, really cool to see just how excited and, like, the beauty that comes from not politicizing everything. Like, that's why everyone watched the draft. That's why, I mean, my friend from Boston was like, I'm going to watch the championship. And I'm like, oh, do you care which team wins? And she's like, Caitlin. I like Caitlin.
Just Caitlin.
Yeah. So it's kind of cool. I don't know. Refreshing as a former athlete to not have to worry about who stands for what. And just let it be the game that it is.
Yeah.
So
and just enjoy sports for what they are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for letting me rant on that.
Oh, anytime. Anytime we can rant. Well, we have a lot to talk about today and a lot of international news, which is why we have our expert Nicole with us here.
Yeah.
So, Kristen, go ahead. Let us know what we have queued up.
Up on today's Problematic Women, Nicole breaks down the latest on Iran's attack of Israel and then breaks down further the conflict of the Middle East. I'm excited to learn more. Plus, tax day was Monday. What's the federal government doing with your money? It will surprise you. And as always, we'll be crowning our Problematic Women of the Week.
Each week on Problematic Women, we sort through the news to find those stories that are of particular interest to conservative-leaning or problematic women, those whose views and opinions are often excluded by those on the so-called feminist left.
If you are a problematic woman or just someone who supports strong, independent women, please consider supporting us by leaving a review or rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and encouraging others to subscribe. It really does make a difference.
All right, let's get to it. All right, so let's set the stage. Saturday, Iran launched 300 drones and missiles at Israel. And unlike other attacks, this was not carried out by Iran's proxy terrorist groups like the Houthis or Hezbollah, but by the nation of Iran itself. And Israel's military, they did succeed in blocking 99% of those drones and missiles that were fired at Israel. That's according to Israeli officials. But the big question is, why and what happens now? So as far as why they attacked, Iran says that the attack was in response to Israel striking an embassy building in Damascus that killed 7 Iranian officials. And Israel hasn't specifically said, yes, that was us. It does, as far as obviously from Iran's perspective, it obviously was them. And a lot of international folks think it was. So though, let's talk about what happens now. That's like the bigger question. President Biden has said that the U.S. will not participate in a counteroffensive against Iran. Israel has said that they will respond, but they have not responded, at least as of yet, as of the recording of this podcast. We're waiting. Benjamin Netanyahu, he said, the leader of Israel, he said on Wednesday during a cabinet meeting that he was thanking friends essentially across the world for their support and their defense of Israel. But he said, ultimately, we will make our own decision and the state of Israel will do everything necessary to defend itself, in speaking of the response. So why do you all think that Israel has not responded yet? What is the delay when it's been like 5 days since that initial attack?
Yeah, so one date, I guess, to keep in mind is that Passover is next week. It starts Monday, and then it will last until the week after. And I don't know about the Israeli government, but I would assume that it would not be a nice holiday or a nice sort of religious holiday for these Israelis to be spending in bomb shelters. So they might be waiting until after Passover, which ends the 29th.
Okay.
Might respond beforehand. It's just kind of unclear. There's a little bit of a psychological game happening, right? Like Israel or Iran didn't respond for 2 weeks, right?
Yep.
The attack that Israel carried out was on April 1st, and then Iran didn't attack till the 14th. So they might be, you know, throwing it back at Iran and saying, oh, this, you know, you get to sweat a bit.
You get to sweat. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A little bit of a chess game.
Yeah, a little bit of a chess game. So, yeah, I your guess is as good as mine on when they're going to actually respond. I've been seeing lots of, you know, back and forth exchanges between officials on, you know, social media and then just press releases on, like, don't do it, do it. We will carry it out. But I think the key sort of message is that, you know, Israel has to respond to this attack, right? This was a pretty significant one. In past years, you laid it out very well. Typically, in the last few years, Israel and Iran have conducted this sort of shadow war, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they've never directly responded to each other. Either in most cases, if not all cases, Iran has used its proxies around the region. Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Houthis in Yemen, some proxies in Iran and Syria, and then obviously Hamas has been conducting attacks since October 7th.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this is pretty significant. This is the first sort of direct attack by Iran on the Israeli landmass, right?
Wow.
So it's pretty, you know, pretty significant, not something to just ignore per se. I wanted to talk a little bit about the April 1st strike that Israel did.
Yeah, if you would clarify that.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, the Iranians are saying, oh, you know, we're just responding to the attack that Israel conducted against us. But let's dig into a bit of the details, right?
Yeah.
So first of all, this strike that happened, it was on this Iranian consulate compound, right, in Damascus, Syria. And these are IRGC officials, right? These are not Iranian diplomats. This is, you know, 2 high-level commanders from the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. They are the masterminds behind all the attacks happening against U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria, against Israelis, right? These are not, like, they're not just going and being diplomatic,
yeah,
right? So I wouldn't say this is, you know, an equal response. 300 missiles, I mean, these are, you know, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, suicide drones. That's significant, right? And, you know, credit to the Israelis. I mean, they came out relatively unscathed. There were sort of a few missiles that made it past their defense systems that hit an airbase. Mm-hmm. There was another sort of instance where a Bedouin girl, she was injured, seriously injured. Yeah. But, you know, typically, you know, credit to sort of a few factors. One is that Israel has, you know, pretty significant air defense systems. They've got the Iron Dome, and then they have, you know, another one that was deployed recently called Arrow 3. And this intercepted, you know, 99% of what came through. In addition to that, like these, you know, these air defense systems, they can get overwhelmed, right? They're not perfect. And past attacks, when this has happened, you know, maybe the Iron Dome's 90% effective. And like if it's 300 missiles and drones, I mean, 10% of that is 30, right? So it could have been worse. But, you know, the Iron Dome and the Arrow 3 did what it was supposed to do. And there was also, you know, credit to the Brits, credit to the U.S. and also the Jordanians who use combat aircraft to shoot down some of these missiles and suicide drones before they even reached Israel's homeland, right?
Wow.
So, you know, it was a joint effort, I would say. But, you know, it could have been worse, I would say. But, you know, it didn't have to be here. And I would love to dig into that, like why we got here. This is a culmination of many events.
It's not an accident.
Over the years, right? It's just a pattern of escalation. So I'd love to sort of discuss
just
that.
Just to walk through that timeline really fast. Obviously, this all started October 7th. But to your point, the April 1st attack by Israel was completed by Israel. And was it an embassy? Or it was some sort of Iranian, where those two individuals, and so that's what started it, right? Which caused then on Sunday, the 14th, right, for the missile strike to occur.
Yeah.
And from what I've heard, and obviously do not follow foreign affairs as much as as you do, obviously. The reason that Iran was then able to, you know, like, or what justified the reaction is because they don't normally, they don't normally attack embassies. Like, usually that's a situation, or there's some locations that aren't military that you are not allowed to attack. So I think, first question, is that true? And is that what happened here? And then second question is, I've seen a lot of commentary on the fact that Iran gave Israel and the U.S. a heads up on this. And that's also why the Iron Dome was able to, you know, react and be as successful as it was, which is awesome.
Right.
And I just wanted your opinion, because there's people that are saying this is actually kind of a good thing that they warned it, because it warned everyone, because it means that they know there are repercussions for their actions and they aren't, you know, as confident in their attacks as it might come off. So I wanted your perspective, just because I don't know what I'm talking about. So walk us through.
Yeah, it's a great question. So just to clarify on the location that was hit. So this is an area of Damascus where all the embassies are, right? Iran has a consulate there. It's diplomatic ground technically, right? But these are not diplomats, right?
Okay.
The IRGC is known for this. They use sort of the laws that govern diplomatic premises, and they go and they stage attacks, right? Because they think they're not going to get hit. But again, these are not diplomats.
When the rhetoric is that they've attacked a diplomatic site, it's
right.
Like, okay, that's cool. That's a loophole.
Right.
Not really the situation here.
Right, exactly. And, you know, the actual residence or the compound itself, like the embassy equivalent, was not hit. It was a building that was in the compound, right? That's been known for as a meeting site for Hezbollah and other IRGC commanders, gotcha. Syrian officials and things like that. So, you know, again, this is not, it is a change, right? Like Israel in the past has targeted specific military sites, but you could argue that this site was also a military site, because this is where they've been planning to carry out attacks that have against U.S. forces, against Israel. And so, you know, these are not just innocent people. And it's, you know, the way the Iranians, of course, want to frame it that way because it makes it look worse than it actually is.
Right, the narrative.
Cool. Yeah. And then sort of on your second question, you know, of whether Iran gave advance notice. So I've been seeing a lot of that sort of swirling on social
media.
And this
is how people are justifying.
Yeah, yeah, people are justifying. They're using it to justify. So, you know, the Biden administration has been pretty clear about this. They came out recently and said, like, look, there's this all this news about that them about the Iranians giving the Israelis and us advance notice. That's completely false. Like, that's fake news.
Oh,
and so, you know, yeah. And, you know, maybe I don't know. Like, I only have access to what's in the open source. So there's a possibility that they maybe have tipped them off. But, you know, these suicide drones, just for context, they take about like 6 hours to reach the territory. Right. So it allows Israel, when they see this being launched and when they see an attack happening, they can prepare in advance, which is why they were able to get aircraft up and to sort of intercept these drones before they've reached it. So it's not like a quick thing. You've got to cross multiple airspaces and, you know, it's further away. It takes longer. Like the attack takes longer than you think. It's not just instant.
Right. No, that's, thank you. That was very interesting. Now, how did we get here?
Yeah. It's a long conversation, right? Like going back to October 7th, you know, this was a pretty significant attack. And since October 7th, you know, the Iranians have for years, you know, they've used these proxies to put pressure on the Israelis in the United States. And after the, you know, Israel launched this the war against Hamas, they've been using their proxies to put pressure, right, on Israel, on the United States to stop, right? And we've seen this in other areas of the region, right? We've seen this in Lebanon along Israel's northern border. Hezbollah has been exchanging cross-border attacks. They've been launching missiles on and crossing this sort of UN-defined, like, demarcated zone. And so Israel's had to face threats from its northern border. You know, you have over 160 attacks from Iranian proxies against U.S. forces. The most significant one killed 4 U.S. soldiers in Jordan, right? So, you know, Iran has been this sort of incident is just a direct confrontation between Israel and Iran that's already been happening through via proxies, if that makes sense, right?
For sure.
And it goes really back to sort of what happened or what policies this administration has taken, right? Like for years, you know, since 2021, the Biden administration has been very weak. They've gone out and they've appeased Iran. They've been dead set on this nuclear deal, thinking that it will solve everything happening in the region. And they, you know, this unfortunately is blown up in their face, right? So, you know, it is a larger conversation, I think, of, you know, of these sort of, you know, like where we're at now is because of all the little things that the Biden administration didn't do leading up to October 7th. And even after October 7th, they've been telling the Iranians, look, we don't want a regional war. We don't want a regional war. Like deterrence is a psychological game, right? Like you don't want to tip your hand to your opponent, right? You want to make them think that they're going to impose very high costs if they do anything against you. And so I think there's just been a lot of missteps and from this administration, and I'm happy to get into more, but
yeah,
the overview.
Yeah, no, Nicole, it's so helpful. And we are going to get into more in just a second. We're going to talk about some of the alliances that we have in the Middle East. And if we are moving towards more conflict, which seems like we are, you know, what is that going to look like? So we're going to talk about some of those alliances and what the U.S. is doing, might do here in a second. But first, want to give you all a quick update, quick announcement. If you're looking for a job, pay attention. The Daily Signal is hiring, and specifically, we're hiring a congressional news reporter. So if you or someone you know is already a congressional news reporter, or maybe that you're just seeking to make a job change and you're interested in the field of reporting, you're interested in Congress, listen up. As the Daily Signal's congressional news reporter, you will have the opportunity to aggressively cover Capitol Hill, develop sources in congressional offices, write breaking news, and deliver insightful reporting on legislative actions, policy debates, and political developments. This role offers a really unique opportunity to inform the public and shape the narrative surrounding key issues that are impacting our nation. You will get to work with one of the best teams in Washington, D.C. In my opinion, the Daily Signal team were pretty fun. So make sure that you check out today's show notes to find a link for how to apply, or you can DM the Problematic Women Instagram account and I'll send you the application there. Hope that you consider applying. All right, so back to Israel and Iran. So after Iran launched the missiles at Israel, it was a Saturday. I think I found out the news around 6 o'clock on Saturday. And my first thought went to, that's an act of war. Is Israel going to declare war on Iran? If Israel declares war on Iran, does that mean the U.S. is automatically also at war with Iran per our treaty? And I didn't know what kind of agreement the U.S. has in relations with Israel. We're obviously very close. Our partnership is close. And I didn't realize until I had a podcast conversation, did a Daily Signal podcast, Nicole, with your boss, Robert Greenway. And he was like, no, there's nothing actually in writing that says if Israel goes to war, the U.S. has to also go to war. And I was like, okay, that's helpful to know. I didn't feel bad about not knowing that because my roommate who works in international affairs and is very familiar with Middle East policy also didn't know that. So I was like, all right, probably a lot of people don't know that. Of course, the relationship between the U.S. and Israel is very close. It's very strong. But that got me thinking about, okay, if if we were to reach that point where Israel and Iran were specifically at war with each other, what would those alliances look like? Who's getting involved? Who's maybe only involved in word of kind of saying, hey, yeah, we back you, but we're not getting involved? Who's maybe just involved financially? What are China and Russia doing? What, I mean, and obviously a lot of this is speculation, but there is a certain amount that we know based on previous statements, previous actions. So let's just say within the next year, Israel and Iran are at war. Who is taking what side?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. My simple answer is I really don't know, right? I can speculate, right? And I'm going to try to do that.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of interesting... So alliances in the Middle East are very complicated, right? They're not simple things. And they've gone through sort of an evolution in recent years. During the last administration, you may have heard of the Abraham Accords that happened.
Yes.
It was a, you know, a normalization agreement between Israel, Bahrain, and the UAE, and a few others. Morocco is involved, and so was Sudan. And, you know, it really changed the calculus because prior to that agreement, Egypt and Jordan had normalization agreements that go back to the Camp David Accords. But this was like the first time that Gulf countries were starting to think about sort of normalization with Israel. And, you know, prior to the lead up of October 7th, it was, I mean, it's not insignificant that Biden was starting to negotiate a possible normalization agreement between the Saudis and the Israelis, which would be like the golden, it would be like the gem, right, of this normalization process. The Saudis have a bunch of resources. They occupy a huge landmass. And, you know, a lot of Saudis and the Emiratis in particular have been really worried about Iran for years, right?
Yeah.
And appreciated the, you know, the fact that this last administration was so, I guess, aware of like how threatening the Iranians really could be. And it brought the region together in a way that it hadn't in the past, right? But that's really, you know, I was studying the Middle East and, you know, Arabs are very much about personal relationships, right? It's built over time. It's not something simple.
Okay.
It's very personal. And so these things take time, right? And the last administration really focused on nurturing those relationships, right, with these Gulf partners to get to the point where they would be comfortable normalizing, right? Because it's not a popular thing for their populations. Like, most of their populations are still pretty very pro-Palestinian. And so it's a big step for them, right? And we did get there, right, with the Abraham Accords. But this administration, when it came into office, it wouldn't even call it the Abraham Accords. It called it these normalization agreements. And it ignored it for a good year to focus on a nuclear deal with Iran that ended up not going anywhere, right? Because the Iranians really did not want the deal. They were already doing everything they wanted to. There were no consequences, right? So why would they... Why would they create a deal with the United States about this to limit what they already were doing, right? And so since that time, right, October 7th, you have the lead up to October 7th, the Saudis are getting close. At least there are news speculation that there's going to be a deal that's imminent. And then October 7th happens and it kind of stops all of those discussions because it's complicated, right? Like the Saudis have to be very careful about how they interact and how they support or not support what's going on, right? And so that's kind of cooled a bit, right? But what's interesting is if we look at this past attack by Iran, you do see a couple of very interesting things. One is the fact that Jordan and Saudi both indicated that any of the missiles or drones that would cross into their airspace, they would shoot down, right? And they didn't say it was because to support Israel, right? They said it's because it's a violation of our sovereignty and our airspace, right?
Okay.
So that is significant somewhat, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Jordanians have always had a really interesting relationship with the Israelis. They do have a peace agreement going back to Camp David, as I said, but it's always been tense, right? Jordan has a huge Palestinian population. They haven't done a census since like the 1970s. And so, you know, some estimates say it's like 70% of their population has Palestinian heritage of some sort. So they have to be very careful. They're also a strong U.S. partner, right? And so I don't know what's going to happen, right? I do think that both, you know, Israel and most of the Gulf countries recognize that Iran is the greatest threat to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might see at least underneath the table, like some, you know, indications of support, like, hey, we will, if there is anything crossing our airspace, we'll shoot it down, right? We're not doing it for you, we're doing it for us, but we're really doing it for you, right? So, and they've been doing this for years, right? So you might not see vocal support, right? But you might see, like, they help participate in, you know, if the Iranians launch rockets or missiles or things like that. So it's complicated.
It's very complicated.
It's, you know, it's never boring in my region, that's what I say. So...
No, that's really, really helpful just to understand those dynamics. And I think it's the perfect way to say it, to say it's complicated, because it's not just, oh, they're automatically going to stand against Israel, but there's a recognition of Iran is a threat to all of us. So even if we're not for Israel, we're not for Iran. I mean, yeah.
What I will say is that, like, no one wants this regional war, right? Like, okay. It is bad for business. Like,
yeah.
If anything, these Gulf countries for years have been trying to diversify their economies. They're trying to bring foreign investors. Like, a war does not bode well for that, right? Mm-hmm. So no one wants it.
Yeah.
Now, China and Russia is interesting, right? I've been seeing some statements that have come out, stronger statements than I've seen in the past, right? Like, so Russia's relationship with Israel has always been kind of complicated because they also heavily support the Syrian regime, which has been very anti-Israel and is for years, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, but Russia's always tried to kind of reach this equilibrium almost with Israel. But the attack that happened from Iran was actually kind of interesting. So China and Russia both said similar, like came out with similar statements. They said that Iran was acting in self-defense of its interests, right?
Okay.
And they're pretty strong about that. I mean, they said, you know, it was in response to the April 1st attacks, right? So, you know, who knows what that will actually amount to.
A little disturbing.
I mean, Russia's kind of bogged down right now with Ukraine. And so I don't know if any sort of larger level conflict breaks out. I don't know how much support they can really give to this conflict. I mean, China, while it does have military assets, it doesn't really have any in the region. They have one overseas base in Djibouti. They can't really do much. And most of their focus is on what's happening in the Indo-Pacific. So I don't think that they'll deploy any hard power to the region in this.
Okay. Yeah. I guess that's good.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
We count our wins.
Yeah, count our wins when we can.
Yeah, really. Wow. Okay. Well, Nicole, thank you. This is just so insanely helpful to get this breakdown. Like, Kristen and I are both like wide-eyed. Like,
yes.
So helpful. But I know that there was more news recently on a domestic front that involves all of us sitting in this room and every single person listening, if you have a job. That's tax day.
Oh yeah. I was like, where is she going with that transition? But she you landed the plane. I hope everyone paid their taxes. That was Monday.
It was indeed.
I usually get it in beforehand, so I'm not the person, you know, like clicking away on my computer
madly.
On Monday. Yes. Super stressed. Or at least received an extension. Some people I heard on my floor actually at work, some people received an extension to complete it. So that's you. Good job. But yeah, no, I hope everyone did pay their taxes because the government is in desperate need for some money. I don't know if you know that or not, desperately needs our money. At least that's what we're meant to believe. After the government collected, I saw a number out there that was an average of $14,000 in income tax this year from Americans. And obviously, you know, we've got our tax brackets, so maybe that looks different for you. Maybe that looks different for other people. But collecting on average $14,000, that's a lot of money if you multiply American population. Yeah.
Yeah.
In reality, though, I'm here to share the not-so-great news. Congress's most recent version of the FY24 package shows anything but them needing our money. They're putting a lot of tax dollars towards some progressive programs, including girl-centered climate action programs. And I think the most ridiculous one was a grant to teach transgender boys how to avoid becoming pregnant. So we've got some really great resources from here at Heritage. Mm-hmm. David Ditch is one of our in-house economists, and he actually put out a mega thread on some of the gimmicks and earmarks and wins in the appropriations bill. And not a ton of wins. There are some interesting promises to cut spending, but not a ton. I wanted to go over just a few of the crazier programs. I've kind of alluded to some of them, and I'm sure you guys have seen some on the news as well. But going from kind of most crazy to least, $850,000 in this new bill would go towards the Pride, which is a group that's trying to create an LGBTQ senior housing facility. It's actually going to be taking over a middle school. So that's, I don't know, that's interesting. We've got $400,000 going to Wisconsin to Briar Patch Youth Services, which is basically a gender affirmation center. I don't even want to say this, but on social media, they kind of brag about being like the go-to for tucking and binding and all of that weird stuff that makes me feel uncomfortable.
This is why I work on international relations. I don't have to deal with this.
It's less touchy-feely. It's more focused on missiles.
Yes.
And then the last one that I wanted to point out today was the $740,000 in Maryland going towards increasing diversity in state contracting. So whatever state contracts, like there's going to be a little, you know, college box, like check whatever mark for contracting efforts. And for some reason, they need $740,000 to do that. I'm not entirely sure. I saved the best for last, and that is the $3 million going to girl-centered climate action in Brazil. Not sure why I need that. I don't know. Like, I'm thinking budget-wise.
In Brazil.
Right, in Brazil. Like, I don't know. But I wanted your thoughts. What do we think the worst program here is? And did you guys pay your taxes? I don't know. Like,
I did pay my taxes, so that's good.
Good. I'm proud of you.
I paid them a little earlier. I think I paid them in February. I still haven't got my tax return though.
Which, refund? Did you get a refund?
Yeah, it's small, but you know, yeah, it's coming. Apparently, it's coming. They tell me it's coming.
Trust the government.
I think the thing that is so crazy about all of these programs is that you look at where our tax dollars could be going, and the number of needs. Like maybe I don't know, secure the border instead of sending tax dollars to Brazil for like climate initiatives. And you just wonder, okay, like what is the driving force? What are the backroom conversations that are happening about where this money is going? What are the end games? And the lack of transparency, I think, that we often see within the federal government is maybe the most disturbing thing of, okay, as an American taxpayer, I should be able to trust that my government is using my money wisely. Well, they have a really hard time even passing a budget. So I've kind of lost hope on that they're using it wisely. But I'm encouraged by people at Heritage who are pulling back the curtain and saying, okay, this information is out there, but most Americans don't have the time or the resources to go looking for, okay, where is this money actually being funneled to and what crazy programs and leftover money that gets lost. That often blows my mind when you hear the stories about the millions, even sometimes like billions of dollars that just quote unquote got lost. Like, where did it go?
Where did it go? What is it funding?
The lack of responsibility is really disturbing within our federal government.
It's scary, too, because with that lack of transparency, you think of it like a job, right? Like, when you're writing an awesome research paper on the Middle East, right? Like, you have checkpoints that you need to accomplish and check off in order to write that, you know, paper, you do that research. And I think that's where a lot of Americans struggle, because we see this huge number of 34 point whatever trillion. I think that's the national debt at this point. And it's like, how did we get here? What are we doing? Where is the success metric for some of these programs and how it's benefiting Americans as a whole and not just, you know, things like that? But I don't know. It's a little discouraging, Nicole. I don't know how you feel. Obviously, potential war in the Middle East. Maybe we could, you know, prepare for that.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually, a point about some of these programs that you mentioned. So in part of my work, I was looking at some women's programs that the U.S. would do abroad. And if you look at sort of just this interagency element, different sort of departments, some have metrics, some really don't. Or they don't have a joint mechanism to measure success, right? So, I mean, there's no oversight, right? Like, no one wants to dig into these actual budgets that are huge and go into all these programs that are very individual. So that's just, you know, comment on what
totally.
You just said.
And we have a really cool program here where we're looking at agencies and what they're spending on. When I was at NASA, the number of duplicate climate action programs that we had was insane. And the amount of money going towards those were insane. And I'm not necessarily putting my flag where climate change is, but we shouldn't have duplicate programs. And I'm assuming the State Department, I'm assuming DOD, I'm assuming a lot of these groups have different versions of the same program that we are funding. And it's kind of like, why?
Yeah, USAID
you wouldn't
and State
do that.
Always have similar programs.
Exactly.
It's like, oh, what's the difference? Don't
exactly. and why not just put more effort towards one to ensure it's successful?
That would require work.
It would.
So
it would. But we're here. We're the next generation. We can change this, guys. Maybe. I don't know. I would like to spend less than $14,000 a year.
That would be nice. Or it would just be not. This would never, ever work or be doable because we have way too many people in this country. But it would be nice if you could offer almost like the same way that you give when you give a donation to a nonprofit. Sometimes you're able to denote like, hey, I would like it to go into this bucket.
Ooh.
If with your tax dollars, you would be like, please spend my tax dollars on fixing like this thing or addressing this issue, which that would never actually work. It's not practical. But it'd be nice if you had some say. I mean, I guess is voting. I guess that's honestly our say is voting about how our
tax
dollars are
spent. This is the beginning of Virginia leading the next Boston Tea Party. I can see it. She's going to go to the Potomac and she's going to, I don't know,
people
dump
will be like,
something.
What are you doing? And she's just like throwing tea bags.
Throwing tea bags.
Oh, yeah.
I want to see that.
All right, well, stay tuned because up next, we crown our problematic woman of the week. We get it. With big media bias, it's hard to find accurate, honest news. That's why we've put together the Morning Bell newsletter, a compilation of the top stories and conservative commentary. To subscribe, just head to dailysignal.com/morningbellsubscription or visit dailysignal.com and click on the connect button at the top of the page. Now it is that time. Once again, it's our favorite time of the week here on the show where we crown our problematic woman of the week. And the crown goes to
Catherine Herridge.
So Catherine Herridge is a journalist, and 1 week ago, she testified before Congress about the importance of protecting privacy and free speech for journalists and their sources. This is a really big deal for the journalist community because as a journalist, you are often looking into situations that are not very popular, that other people don't want you looking into, and you have to have sources that trust to share information with you that they would not share if their name was going to be publicized. We see this all the time when you have whistleblowers, people that speak out, that leak information, that expose corruption, those kinds of things. And so that protection, that safety for journalist sources is critical to journalistic integrity because we would never be able to get sources to talk to us and actually share information or expose what's going on if sources were always in fear of, okay, but if I share this with you, the chances are I might get exposed and lose my job or be publicly shamed or in other countries might even wind up dead if you're exposing the corruption of a really totalitarian nation. So this woman, Catherine Herridge, she has been in the news game for a long time. She's an excellent journalist. She worked for Fox for a while and then went to CBS, but she actually got fired from CBS after she was investigating things like the Hunter Biden laptop story and HERS report that called into question how President Biden was doing cognitively. So she's been on the forefront of some pretty hotly debated issues, but the story that she has been working on and why she testified before Congress and why she's at the center of this First Amendment case is that a judge ordered her to reveal a source on a report that she was doing on a Chinese American scientist. And so she had this Chinese American scientist as a source, and individuals wanted that source to be revealed, and she said no. And for that, she's been taken to court, and she's really continued to be an advocate for freedom of speech and protection for journalists and their sources, and is backing a bill called the Protect Reporters from Exploitative State Spying Act, or the PRESS Act, because a little bit easier to say the PRESS Act. Yeah. So really, really critical, and it was really powerful just hearing her testify before Congress. And she said, my kids asked me, Mom, are you going to go to jail because of this? And her response was, you know, I would so like to be able to answer, oh, that would never happen in America, not in my country mm-hmm. that I love, where we so value freedom of speech, protection of the press. But she's like, I don't know. I honestly don't know how this is going to play out, but I really respect her integrity because it's something that not only affects journalists, but it actually affects the American people and the world about whether or not they will receive honest reporting and reporting that pulls back the curtain on corruption.
And to your point of transparency earlier, you know, there's whistleblowers out there. One at the IRS that felt he literally was like, I feel handcuffed because I'm working on the Hunter Biden, you know, tax stuff, and I don't feel like there was a 5-year probe and he didn't feel like he could do anything like meaningful. Like, you should never feel that way in your job, especially when it comes to accountability for government officials. Like, that is what America was founded on, is Americans being able to ensure the government was serving Americans for America. So really, really exciting. She's a very problematic woman in
Indeed.
The best way.
Yeah. Well, and Nicole, to you're joining us today. Thank you for being a problematic woman.
Yeah, thanks.
And being willing to jump in and share about what is going on in the Middle East. And we look forward to having you back on to continue talking about this, because unfortunately, I think that this is going to continue to be a major hot button issue that we're going to see a lot of news unfold on in the coming weeks, months, years. It's not going away.
Be happy to come on when Israel responds. So
yeah. Yeah. Do we have any guesses on the timeline?
I forgot to mention this. I think we talked about the timeline, Passover and everything,
yeah.
but about what the possible targets might be, right?
Because
also really important to think about. And I actually did a report on this for my boss, Rob, yesterday. So it's right top of mind. But
let's loop back there just for 1 second.
Yeah, 1 second. So I would classify a few different options based on, you know, what would be considered a significant, like a high risk target or high significant target or whatever, and a low risk target, right?
Okay.
So starting from the lowest, what Israel could attack, right? Possibilities include maybe IRGC officials in Iraq and Syria, or proxies themselves and hitting up facilities, or people themselves operating in these areas. They could also take out this spy ship that's stationed near the Red Sea. It's been supplying intelligence to the Houthis to take out these ships and shipping and everything like that. They could do that. That would be considered, I would say, like low impact.
Okay.
And would be not as significant of a target for them. But it's got to be a quote, like an adequate response, right? Because deterrence is the game, right?
Yeah.
Is the name of the game. So that one, I don't know if Iran would be deterred, right, if they decided to do that. Another sort of mid-risk option is a combination of cyber attacks. You might have heard of Stuxnet back in the early 2000s.
Okay.
This was this like software system that this Israeli a hacking system that was placed within their nuclear facilities and disrupted a lot of things. They could do a cyber attack on maybe their electricity grid, something like that. They could do any number of targeted assassinations on IRGC commanders, maybe the people who conducted this recent attack, Air Force commander or something like that. I would say like the highest risk, right? And there's a lot of questions about whether they will actually do this, but, you know, a direct strike on Iranian soil using F-35s or maybe their, you know, their own drones or long-range ballistic missiles, and striking either two things, right, or a combination of things. Maybe the IRGC headquarters, right, near Tehran, or, you know, any number of missile and UAV facilities across Iran.
Okay.
Another one, which is like the prize for Iran that would really, really hurt, but is risky, right, is striking their nuclear facilities, right?
Ooh.
This is something that they've been trying to obtain a nuclear weapon for years, right? So there are two big facilities that the Israelis might want to strike, but again, high risk. One is called Natanz facility. It's right near Tehran. Another one is Fordow facility. This is where like their main nuclear assets are, but they're underneath like this mountain, right? Very, very deep under, it's called the Zagros Mountains.
Hmm.
And we have a bomb that we've never used before. It's called the Bunker Buster Bomb, which is kind of fun to say. What basically happens is like it, you know, it hits the ground and then it releases like a secondary missile that goes deep into the ground. But it's never been used, right?
Wow.
And so let's say Israel had these weapons and let's say that they tried them and then it failed. What would happen, right?
Ooh.
Like, they'd basically show their hand to the Iranians that nothing that they have in their arsenal will stop the Iranians on their path to a nuclear weapon. So there might be a combination, right? Like, and I don't know, you know, the Israelis have been coming out and saying this in the press, but it's always difficult, right?
Mm.
I've been saying, look, we know we want to target Iranian soil, but it's going to be a limited strike. We're not going to try to go past that red line threshold and bring this out into a regional war, because as I said before, like, no one wants that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. We'll see what happens. But those are sort of a few options that Israel could do as it looks to respond.
Okay.
Thanks, Sam.
We're going to be watching this closely. Nicole, thank you again for joining today.
Thanks.
And thanks for all of our listeners for being with us. With that's going to do it for this week's edition of Problematic Women.
Join us next Thursday morning for a brand new edition. And in the meantime, please subscribe and share.
As conservatives, we need your support in the podcast world. So if you would, make sure that you pull out your phone, leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, Google Play, wherever you like to listen. We are across all platforms and we love hearing your feedback.
Have a great week.
Problematic Women is brought to you by more than 500,000 members of the Heritage Foundation.
It is a product of The Daily Signal, produced by Lauren Evans and Virginia Allen. And be sure to follow Problematic Women on Instagram.
We produce Problematic Women in remembrance of our dear friend and former co-host, Bree Payton.